This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On your marks, get set, go. It's a dash to the finish, and that finish will come sometime tomorrow night, we think, as polls close around the country and results come pouring in. And during these last several hours, all eyes are on North Carolina and a few other key states that may decide the outcome of the presidential election, while the result of North Carolina's Senate race may contribute to tipping the balance of power in Congress. Before all of this comes to a blessed end, we take a look at how North Carolina suddenly became important in the presidential contest with the rest of the country. What the rest of the country wants to know about us, and given recent events here, I'm told they have a lot of questions, and how Tar Heels may help the direction or set the direction of the country for the next 4 years. We have a very big welcome back to a guy who never stops working. I walked in here this morning. I know he posted an extremely long blog yesterday that I read at 11 o'clock last night, and he's still typing away here when I walked into the studio, and that is Dr. Michael Bitzer, one of our go-to guys when it comes to politics. The good news, bad news for him is that several news outlets call upon his expertise in this time of what?
Trials and tribulations.
And in his spare time, on holidays and weekends, and beginning Thursday evening at 6, he is provost and professor of political science at Catawba College. Welcome back.
Always good to be here.
We'll be joined by Ron Elving from NPR in a moment. He's stuck in traffic in Washington. We're going to talk about a lot of things, but let's start with the latest FBI development. FBI Director James Comey released another letter yesterday saying that the Bureau had been working around the clock since his first letter to Congress a week ago, and that investigation reveals no new charges for Hillary, and in fact, the FBI had not changed their initial conclusion of no wrongdoing on Clinton's part. Now, we know that Hillary took a hit in the polls when James Comey released his initial letter to Congress. Is it too late for her to benefit from being cleared, if there is any benefit from being cleared?
Yeah, I think this is so close. I mean, when you're talking 48 hours before people start heading to the polls, this has been a bizarre election to begin with, and the constant increase in terms of surprises. I mean, we talked literally every day in October mm-hmm. about the October surprise. This was the November surprise. I think what this does is it probably helps Democrats to feel a little more comfortable with casting their votes for Hillary Clinton. In the grand scheme of things, things are so polarized, nobody's minds are going to be changed necessarily.
So yesterday, after this announcement came out and the letter was posted and you could see it on television and read every word that James Comey wrote to Congress the second time around, Donald Trump got off his airplane, I believe it was in Minnesota, and talked about crooked Hillary and how she was going to be under investigation for her entire administration, and she yep. would be indicted and she would most likely go to jail. Obviously, he did not either get that letter or he chose to ignore that letter because it would not be in his best interest to drop that talking point.
Right.
She had several campaign stops in the aftermath of that letter, and she never mentioned it either. Is that smart?
I think for her, anytime the word emails comes up, that's never a good thing. I mean, she just needs to push this aside and be focused on finishing out this campaign. And I think anytime that the words email come out of her lips and are on TV or whatever, that is a bad opportunity.
But this
for
is an
her.
Exoneration.
It is, so to speak. But for most folks, 98% of folks, this is already done. This election is baked in, and I just don't see how this necessarily changes anybody's minds. It may give greater help to getting Democrats out, because then they can say, look, she's been exonerated. Move on with this. For Republicans, they're going to say, well, there's something crooked going on and the system is rigged yet again.
Well,
it plays into everybody's narrative.
Republicans have been saying that, particularly about the Clintons, mm-hmm. that they're constantly under investigation. Her administration will be constantly under investigation, etc. But it's been under investigation by them and since the 90s, and nothing ever seems to stick. They never find the smoking gun. Why?
I think this is the polarization that we are just in. Republicans just will not give up on this. Democrats, particularly the Clintons, tend to do it to themselves, unfortunately, and for their sake. And it's just the environment that we're in. And I'm afraid over if Secretary Clinton gets elected, this is what we have to face for the next 4 years.
So the race ends tomorrow and the new race begins on Wednesday if she wins. Michael Bitzer is in our studio from Catawba College, and now we're joined by NPR senior editor, correspondent, and frequent political analyst Ron Elving. He was previously the political editor for USA Today and for Congressional Quarterly. He's been on this program before. Welcome back, and congratulations for navigating Capitol Hill traffic.
Don't know what's going on out there, but it's worse today than usual.
So we started the program talking about the FBI letter that was released yesterday, which essentially exonerates Hillary Clinton and puts her back to where she was in July, essentially, when he said she wasn't guilty of any wrongdoing. What are these two releases of information by the FBI say about the politicization of the FBI, Ron?
You know, some of us do remember a fellow by the name of J. Edgar Hoover,
yes,
who was the director of the FBI forever, starting with the formation of the FBI way back before World War II, and carried the Bureau through many years, not only of crime fighting, but also of fighting communism and fighting what they saw as radicalism in the United States, sometimes fighting against racial prejudice, sometimes fighting against the Ku Klux Klan, but getting involved in many, many essentially political struggles. And of course, many people remember that the FBI was very active in terms of suppressing the Black Panther Party in the 1960s, 1970s. So the FBI has been politicized in the past. More recently, the professional reputation that has attached to the FBI in terms of criminal matters has extended to their handling of many other matters as well, including white-collar crime, including what we might think of as political corruption and investigating public affairs events and public figures. So this was a bit of a departure from the handling of politically sensitive matters that we have become accustomed to the FBI doing in the last couple of decades, basically in the period since the 1970s, the post-Watergate period. And we should add, obviously, the FBI was very involved in Watergate, a very political issue as well.
Whether this was a result of the politicization of the FBI or whether this is just politics playing out in front of our eyes, big time politics playing out in front of our eyes. When the FBI came out 9 days ago, I think it was, and said, we're going to open this email of investigation up again, a lot of Democrats said, now, wait a minute. You already cleared her once. This is not fair to the election, and she did take a hit in the polls. And then they said, well, why aren't you investigating alleged connections between Donald Trump and Russia? Are they investigating that? And if they are investigating that, why wouldn't they release something simultaneously to say, we're also looking into Donald Trump?
In recent times, the custom of the FBI has been to exercise extraordinary restraint, be extraordinarily taciturn. They have been investigating members of Congress who were eventually going to be indicted on various kinds of charges and never said a word about it until the indictment was actually ready, and tried to stay as far away from election day, as far away from primary day, mm-hmm. as they possibly could. Now, we obviously saw in the case of Secretary Hillary Clinton a special pressure brought to bear on the FBI because one of our two political parties was trying very hard to win this election largely by going after Hillary Clinton and all her vulnerabilities that you've already spoken about. So it was back in the summer when the evidence had been gathered over many, many months by many, many agents, hundreds of agents who had been involved, to try to figure out whether or not this private email server she used as Secretary of State was some kind of violation of the law, there was some sort of intent of that, or someone had perhaps perjured themselves during the investigation, thoroughly going through all of that, James Comey felt he not only had to make a recommendation to the attorney general, who said she was leaving it up to him, but that he had to go out and have a news conference about it to explain that even though there was some stuff that looked pretty bad, it actually wasn't criminal. So he did that in July, and that was a departure from the more recent behavior of the FBI, a departure from the more taciturn and restrained behavior of the FBI right there. That, of course, gets him dragged up to Capitol Hill by Republican chairman of the committees that were also interested in Hillary Clinton's emails. And they all got from him a promise that he would absolutely be willing to tell them if anything new came up. So normally, if something new came up, they would look at the something new before they did anything or made any sort of public pronouncement. But Comey felt that because he had made this pledge to those chairmen of those committees, he had to tell them as soon as they started looking at anything that might be relevant again. And that, of course, was former Congressman Anthony Weiner's laptop with a lot of emails that once might have come from Hillary Clinton. Turns out there was nothing to see there.
So was that promise a mistake?
You know, a lot of people are going to say that it was a mistake. A lot of people would have said it would have been better for Comey not to have had that news conference in the first place, but simply to say no charges, pass that on to Loretta Lynch. But here's another way that the whole Clinton legacy comes back into play. If James Comey tells his boss, Attorney General Loretta Lynch, that he doesn't see any charges here, and Loretta Lynch announces that. Now, she's a political appointee of Barack Obama, and she is a Democrat. James Comey is a Republican. And if she makes that announcement after she had had a brief meeting with Bill Clinton on a tarmac in Arizona previously, which they say was just a social call. He had appointed her to a U.S. attorney job way back in the 1990s, and he stopped by to say hi. But, of course, it looked very much as though he stopped by to say, hey, Loretta, you're going to step on any kind of charges that the FBI might recommend, aren't you? So a lot of people gave it that coloration. So she felt that she really needed to put this on Comey, and when Comey got it on his shoulders, he felt he had to have a news conference to explain all the ins and outs of it. That got him dragged up to Capitol Hill, where they extracted a promise, and that promise was fulfilled on October 28th. And then to roll that back when nothing new was found, Comey had to make an announcement before the election.
So he has 7 years left on his term as FBI director. The FBI director serves 10 years. If Hillary Clinton is elected tomorrow, will she have to deal with him for 7 years? Can they heal this, or will there be a resignation forthcoming from the FBI?
I would believe that, first of all, she would sit down with James Comey and say, I'm going to be president for the next 4 years and possibly beyond that. You have a tenure for 7 years. You and I need to work together. And I'm sure James Comey would say something similar back to her. Mm-hmm. He does not want to resign, certainly in a short term, because that would look as though in some sense or another he had erred or sinned. Now, some people believe James Comey has political aspirations of his own down the road, that he would like to run for public office. He certainly would not have idealized the 2016 that he has just had if that is indeed his long-term intent.
Okay. We are here, believe it or not, to talk about North Carolina's role in this upcoming election, and Election Day is tomorrow. North Carolina finds itself in the spotlight for the first time in a very long time, with pundits saying that we are going to be, maybe along with Florida, maybe along with Ohio,
Nevada,
you name Michigan. It. But supposedly we're the shining star in all this. We're going to be the deciding factor. When we come back, I want to find out if the two of you actually believe that about North Carolina, and then we'll talk more about our influence on this election and what people who find us in the national spotlight who live elsewhere are asking about this state and what's going on here. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar. New location opening soon at The View in downtown Charlotte near BB&T Ballpark. Full portfolio of wine and beer from all over the world, plus live music. Details at thecorkscrew.com. And UNC Charlotte Department of Theater presenting She Kills Monsters based on the fantasy role-play game Dungeons & Dragons, November 16th through 20th. Details at arts.uncc.edu. A mini city may soon be coming to a riverbank near you. An enormous mixed-use development of apartments, homes, offices, retail, restaurants, and parks, dubbed the River District, will soon get a city council vote. And we take a closer look at that project on this program tomorrow at 9. And tomorrow night at 7, you are invited to join an election night results party watch at Free Range Brewing on North Davidson Street. We'll be there at 7 to listen and watch coverage from WFAE News and NPR.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the framers of the U.S. Constitution gave us three separate branches of government, executive, legislative, and judicial, to keep any one person or group from having too much power, how the U.S. government is supposed to work, and why many think the system is broken.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Dr. Michael Bitzer, Provost and Professor of Political Science at Catawba College, and Ron Elving, Senior Editor and Correspondent with NPR. We're talking about the election, Election Day being tomorrow. So, is it true, do both of you agree, that North Carolina could be the linchpin in this election? Michael.
I think for particularly Donald Trump, there is no conceivable path through the Electoral College that does not have North Carolina in his column. And he has to run a perfect hand in order to really have any sense of an opportunity to get to 270 votes. And the Electoral College has moved more and more to the Democrats' advantage in terms of demographics, in terms of a lot of things. And he has to have states like Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and still he has to try and flip a kind of lean Democratic state into his column as well. So, yes, North Carolina is crucial. The two polls out this morning, it's dead even at the presidential level, basically. And so we're walking into a basic coin toss kind of an election.
Ron, what's your take?
I do believe North Carolina is critical. If the Clinton campaign can hold what we call the blue wall, now that consists of the states that have been voting Democratic in every presidential election beginning with 1992. Now, those states, if they go for Hillary Clinton, and then if you add in New Mexico, which looks very likely to be with her, Colorado, where she's leading, New Hampshire and Virginia, she can get there with just that. So North Carolina, in that scenario, would be a kind of insurance policy against losing, say, a Michigan, or against losing, say, New Hampshire, or perhaps not getting over the top in Nevada. They're trying and they're hoping to win all those states, but they're probably going to spring a leak somewhere in that blue wall. And that's where North Carolina can be crucial, because it can shore them up if they do lose such a state.
So the blue law, the blue wall, rather, are what states?
Well, it's about 19 states, actually, but it starts with the coasts, and it's the whole West Coast minus Alaska votes Democratic now. When you come east, you've got New York and New England. Then you have Maryland, and it appears Virginia, which is actually not part of the blue wall because it actually has gone back and forth over the last 25 years, but it is now apparently pretty solid in Hillary Clinton's column. So you put all that together along with the big Great Lakes, Midwestern industrial states from Minnesota to Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, which is a top five state and which now is deep blue, whereas it used to be a state that could actually be contested. You put all that together, and if you add in New Mexico, which, as I say, has not voted in every election for the Democrats since 92, but virtually so, and now seems pretty solidly Democratic. It's the most Hispanic state in the country. Mm-hmm. If you add in New Mexico, that gets her all the way to 247 electoral votes, and then she's only 23 shy. So you can see that when you add in a North Carolina, you're pretty much going to be there, but she can also possibly win in a Nevada. She can also possibly win in Florida. I think everyone would agree. I'm sure Dr. Collins would agree that if Florida goes for Hillary Clinton, it's pretty much over.
The final NPR battleground map, which is out this morning, has Hillary Clinton with 274 votes in the Electoral College. You only need 270 to
Correct.
Win. And Trump at 214. And they've placed North Carolina in the toss-up column. But just before we started the program today, Michael, I asked you who you thought would take North Carolina. And you took a deep breath and said, Trump?
Simply because of the dynamics that we seem to be looking at in the early votes. So far right now, we have a little under 3.1 million ballots cast. If we reach the same kind of electoral size, the electorate size that we traditionally tend to see, about 4.5, maybe up to 4.7 million. Barack Obama did very well in the early in-person votes. But this year, the dynamic is fundamentally different from 4 years ago because black voters didn't show up at the same rate that they did 4 years ago. And the true wild card are these huge surge of unaffiliated voters, particularly in urban and suburban North Carolina.
But what I think I'm hearing you and Ron Elving say is that Hillary may not need North Carolina,
right.
But
yeah.
Donald Trump does.
Does. I mean, just fundamentally, just for the very reasons that Ron pointed out, there is no math that gets him to 270 without the 15 electoral votes from North Carolina.
So given that we are in the spotlight and have been in the spotlight for a good part of this election cycle, at least this year, when people call you, and Michael, they call you from all over the country now because, as I said at the beginning, you're the go-to guy on all of this. What do they want to know? What do people from outside the state want to know about North Carolina? And is a lot of their curiosity predicated on the swing that we've taken to the right?
Well, it's that, but it's also the sense of explain to me how North Carolina has become this kind of battleground competitive state. Just remember in 2000 and 2004, George W. Bush won this state by 13 percentage points. We would look at that and say, that's not competitive. That's a solid Republican state. In 2008 and 2010, I argue those are watershed elections because what the Democrats saw was they could make this state competitive. Barack Obama only won by 14,000 votes in this state. Okay, 2010 was the Tea Party insurgency that fundamentally shifted the Republican Party in this state to the right. So you've got the dynamics of those two elections, plus the fundamental shifts going on in our electorate, more urbanized, more millennial voters, more unaffiliated voters. And this kind of reconstructing electoral coalitions for both sides is in upheaval because we don't know what these folks, particularly the unaffiliated, are doing in North Carolina. And that's the big wild card.
So, Ron Elving, is that how we've gotten to this position of being this so-called battleground state, the kingmaker, so to speak?
Yes, and the change is not limited to North Carolina, but it's vivid in North Carolina. There are also more Hispanic people in the United States just about everywhere, but it is surprising, I think, to many folks back west and up in New England and so forth to realize how many Hispanic people there are now in the South, at least in the Atlantic South. You have people moving up from Florida and moving up into Georgia, so that Georgia, while I would not call it competitive this year, is down into single digits, maybe even low single digits between the two parties. And while the Republicans will win, Donald Trump will win in Georgia, it won't be a blowout in Georgia. It probably won't even be a blowout in Texas. Texas is in single digits. That is astonishing to a lot of people because they haven't elected a Democrat to anything statewide in Texas for quite some while. But the Hispanic vote is coalescing this year in terms of opposition to Donald Trump. And while they may not be wild about Hillary Clinton, she is what stands between them and a Donald Trump presidency and all that might portend for the Hispanic community and the immigrant community, Asian immigrants as well. So that's a big motivator. It's a big motivator wherever Hispanic people are. And that is another contributing factor to why some of the states in the South, of course, beginning with Florida, we haven't even really talked about Florida, but beginning there and then spreading through many of the other parts of the South are more competitive than they used to be between the two parties.
I mean, I know we're here to talk about North Carolina and its fulcrum position in all of this, but what about Virginia? I grew up in Virginia. I grew up in Northern Virginia, and Northern Virginia is very much is to Virginia what Mecklenburg County is to North Carolina.
And the Research Triangle areas.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Northern Virginia is not Virginia.
Right.
I don't know what it is, but it's not. You ask anybody else anywhere else in Virginia, and they just thumb their nose at it. So how is it that they're going Democratic this time around?
I would say that the changes that have overtaken Virginia in the last 30 years, I moved to the Washington, D.C. area in the first term of Ronald Reagan, so more than 30 years ago. At that time, Virginia was quite heavily Republican. They would elect a Democratic governor sometimes, but the congressional delegation was overwhelmingly Republican, two Republican senators. Even Northern Virginia was electing Republicans and quite conservative Republicans at the time, behaving like a classic collar county kind of voting pattern where the people who had moved out from the inner city were heavily white and more affluent and tended to be Republican. That was the Virginia of the 1980s. Now, in Virginia, it is becoming not just a purple state, but a pretty consistently voting blue state that elects Democrats to statewide office, that has Democrats dominating now to a large degree in Northern Virginia, where they win the legislative seats and the congressional seats by and large, and providing a very healthy Democratic vote for Democratic presidential nominees. And then you add into that, and this is also a Northern Virginia phenomenon, but also is true in other parts of Virginia as well, a robust Hispanic population that is growing, and that includes more and more people who were born in the United States and includes more and more people who are registering to vote. So we're not talking here about illegal immigrants. We're not talking about people in the shadows. We're talking about fully incorporated citizens of the United States, many of them born in the United States, who are Hispanic and who are voting, and that's made a huge difference in Virginia.
I think Virginia gives us a glimpse of where North Carolina is heading. And the way that I look at it is, with the urbanization and particularly college-educated individuals, if you look at that ring around D.C., that northern Virginia, that used to be solid Republican. Now it has trended blue, just like Mecklenburg, just like the research triangle. So Virginia is maybe two election cycles ahead of where North Carolina is, and North Carolina is two election cycles ahead of where Georgia is. I think there's a pattern going on in the South.
But we talked just about, I think it was last week, excuse me, we talked last week about the urban-rural divide in the country. In Northern Virginia, Alexandria, the city of Alexandria, Arlington, Virginia, Fairfax County, Virginia, are part of that urban core of the Washington metropolitan area.
Yeah.
And then you got Virginia, and there are no real big cities in Virginia. Richmond, Hampton Roads, Norfolk, at least in North Carolina, you have Greensboro, you have Raleigh-Durham, Chapel Hill, you have us. It's completely we seem to have more big cities.
Well, we have more big cities, but remember, out of the 100 counties, 50% of tomorrow's vote total will come from basically 12 of those counties. And that's the dynamic that the powerhouse of the urban vote is really kind of shifting. And when those urban areas trend more and more Democratic, that's where you get the built-in advantage in terms of statewide numbers.
So talk about Florida, Ron. We haven't talked about Florida. You want to talk about Florida. They have a large elderly population, which one would imagine would be very conservative in their voting tendencies. And then you have a very large Hispanic population in Florida. Are they canceling each other out?
Not in a perfect sense, and you cannot overgeneralize about either of those groups. Traditionally, Hispanic voters in Florida have been quite different from Hispanic voters in other places, say California. They don't come as predominantly from Mexico, and they include Cubans, who, as we know, have been a tremendously politically active group of people who have really gotten into our politics. We have Marco Rubio as a senator. We have Ted Cruz, a senator from Texas, and two of the strong presidential bidders this year in the primaries for the Republicans, two people to watch in the future. But that Cuban vote that used to be solid block Republican because of their abhorrence of the Castro regime in Cuba is now, especially the younger ones, much more open to the Democratic Party, especially because many of them think that the opening to Cuba of the Obama administration is a good thing, and they're bringing some of the older folks along with them. So we no longer have a huge stronghold of Republican vote within the Hispanic vote because of the Cuban community, and some of the other Hispanic groups from other places, from the islands, from South America, are much more open to the Democratic message. And it appears from early voting in Florida that this group is mobilized as never before, and they are heavily involved in stopping Donald Trump in their own minds, whether they love Hillary Clinton or not. Some may, many don't. And they just know they don't want a Donald Trump presidency, and they seem to be getting involved as never before in Florida. Now, there is a Quinnipiac poll that has not always been the friendliest poll to Hillary Clinton, that has just come out this morning, and it shows Florida as pretty much a dead heat, Clinton by 1 point, with Johnson only getting 2%. This poll does not add up all the way to 100% because we still have undecided voters. One wonders what it is going to take for those people to decide, and my suspicion is that in the end, they will be non-voters.
So if you have a toss-up in Florida and you have a toss-up in North Carolina, what does that mean?
It's going to be a late Tuesday.
Really? You think it's going to – because both of these are East Coast states. The polls close at 7, 7:30. Won't we know by 8, 9 o'clock?
I'd be cautious to say yes.
Ryan?
My guess is that everyone's going to be watching that 7:30 poll close in North Carolina very, very closely. Some of the polls in Florida out in the panhandle don't close until later. And it's going to be so close in both states, I don't think we're going to get an early call in either one. So we'll be up late watching for those two states. Certainly the Trump folks will be. And the other question to ask is, how are things going in the wall? Mm-hmm. Pennsylvania. Yeah. That's been a big focus for the Trump folks. I'm going to say Ohio is just going to go for Trump. I think Iowa is going to go for Trump. Those are two swing states that the Democrats have competed in. Hillary Clinton's gone through Ohio just in recent hours. But they don't really expect, I don't think, to win in Ohio or certainly in Iowa. Those states are lagging the diversity change in American demographics just a little bit, especially Iowa. And Ohio has actually been ground zero for a lot of Trump's anti-trade or anti-trade deals message. And so there's every chance that he wins Ohio and Iowa. That's a good sign for any Republican on the way to the White House. But he needs to add a Pennsylvania or a Michigan or a Wisconsin, or else he's going to have to absolutely run the table on all the battleground states. And that's tough to do.
So is there anything that makes North Carolina particularly different from some of these other so-called battleground states like Florida, like Ohio, like Michigan? Is there anything particularly different about
us? Well, we've been seeing more and more people moving into the state. And, you know, we talk about the Rust Belt, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin. People are leaving those areas. They're coming south. North Carolina has benefited from an in-migration, certainly. Those new North Carolinians are fundamentally reshaping the state as well. And I think what they're doing is they're moving to the urban areas. They're moderates. They're perhaps, social, more moderate, more liberal in that regard. And they are registering unaffiliated. But I think the influence is as powerful as anything else going on in the state.
Given the fact that as a battleground state, our vote matters.
Yeah, very much so.
More so than it would if we were not a battleground state.
Correct.
How long can we maintain this position? In 4 years, will we still be a battleground state? Will we be eight years?
So. I think this is the new North Carolina, from what I've been seeing. And I think we are in this pattern. If Virginia continues to move more and more Democratic, I think we will do so as well. The demographics, particularly of millennials, are trending us into that direction. But I think this is what we have come to expect, and this is unleashed in terms of the competitiveness of the state.
Only have 30 seconds here, but which would be the bigger surprise, that Hillary wins North Carolina or that Donald Trump wins North Carolina?
Right now, I'd say Hillary winning North Carolina would be the bigger surprise.
Do you agree with that, Ryan?
And I would agree.
Okay. We're going to come back. We're going to talk more about the down ballot race and what battleground means in that area and what the key race, the presidential race, means for the people on lower on the ticket, so to speak, when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Belk College of Business, offering 13 MBA concentrations in areas such as analytics, energy, and real estate. More at mba.uncc.edu. And Mecklenburg County Solid Waste, America Recycles Day is Saturday, November 12th, hosting a paper shredding event at 2145 Suttle Avenue, 8 a.m. to noon. Limit of 3 banker boxes. Wipeoutwaste.com. The framers of the Constitution gave us 3 separate branches of government, executive, legislative, and judicial, to keep any one person or group from having too much power. How the U.S. government is supposed to work and why many think it is broken. The topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. on the Diane Rehm Show. You can join ours right now at charlottetalks at WFAE.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook or reach us through Twitter at charlottetalks. And we are coming right back.
Robin Ciordia, owner of The Secret Chocolatier, a WFAE underwriter.
I recommend underwriting with WFAE all the time. It has been the most worthwhile source that we have done for getting our name and our brand out there. I would definitely say that you can get new customers as well as remind your current customers what you're doing and who you are.
Find out more. Email underwriting at WFAE.org for details.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the battleground status of North Carolina here with Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College and Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent for NPR. As we go down the ballot, if Hillary wins North Carolina, even by a hair, does that tell you that we'll also have a Democratic governor? And is the reverse also the case if Donald Trump wins North Carolina? Is Pat McCrory going to win the governor's race?
I think North Carolina has trended more towards voters who do straight party ticket voting, you know, basically just working their way down the ballot in the same column.
Is that why they've eliminated that one lever that pulls the whole thing?
That was a surprise to me because it certainly benefited Republicans just as much as it benefited Democrats. Mm-hmm. But I think this year we may see a return to the split ticket voter in North Carolina, but a different type of split ticket voter. We used to talk about Jessecrats, Democrats, particularly rural, conservative, down east Democrats who would always vote for Jesse Helms, a Republican, but they would go back to being Democrats at other levels. I think this year the split ticket voter may be urban and suburban, particularly Republicans in this environment. And the question I have is, how willing are they to vote Republican at the presidential level? Could they vote for Hillary Clinton and then bounce over and vote for Richard Burr, mm-hmm. and then perhaps bounce back over and vote for Roy Cooper? I think in this county, particularly Mecklenburg, the big question in my mind is how many votes does Pat McCrory lose in Mecklenburg because of HB2 and because of the I-77 toll roads in the northern part of the county? This could be his fault line in terms of losing, you know, 75,000-100,000 votes out of this county. That's huge to try and make up in rural counties that don't have that great of a population.
And what about this the Senate race? Are there coattails attached to that, depending upon who wins the presidency?
It could be. I think, you know, the Senate race has kind of taken its own dynamic. All of these races are functioning under their own dynamics, but at some point they will all have to come into alignment with each other. So, yeah, I mean, there could be that. I could see if it's Clinton, Burr, and you know, we see a split ticket going on there.
People are angry about Washington's inability to get anything done, and they have been unable to get things done because of this split between the parties and the unwillingness to compromise on anything. And it seems to me that if Hillary Clinton were to win the presidency, it's almost a mandate that she must take back the Senate. The Democrats must take back the Senate, or she'll get nothing done. So, Ron, given the fact that we have a Senate race going on here, how important does that make us in terms of the outcome of the Senate race in North Carolina?
It's right down to the last seat. Right now, if I had to bet, I would probably be most comfortable putting my chips on 50-50. I literally... Mm-hmm. Split Senate, we've seen it before. Yeah. It happened in the 2000 election. There were 50 Republicans and 50 Democrats, and or at least 50 people caucusing with the Democrats, whether they called themselves that or not. And Dick Cheney, as the vice president of the United States after that little affair we had in Florida in 2000, Dick Cheney was empowered to break that tie and break it in order to give the Republicans control of all the committees. That he did. 6 months later, one of the Republicans switched parties, became an independent, and Dick Cheney was not able to break the tie on organization anymore, and the Democrats took over. So we might be looking at a scenario very much like that, where we go from a 50-50 Senate, where whoever wins the presidency thus wins the vice presidency, thus gets the right to break ties in the Senate, and thus makes it that party's control of the Senate. And if that should happen, and let us say it's Clinton and Kaine, then Tim Kaine, who is himself actually a senator, would get to break the tie. And then when he is eventually replaced in the Virginia Senate, there will be a caretaker appointed in his place who would be a Democrat. And then when they have an election, that election will determine which party holds the Senate. But there's at least enough time in there for perhaps Hillary Clinton to perhaps confirm one appointment to the Supreme Court and fill the ninth chair there, vacated by the death of Antonin Scalia. That's very much hanging fire. The Republicans refused to conduct the usual process this year to fill that seat, and so it will still be vacant when the new president is inaugurated in January.
If she wins, do you think the Republicans will not proceed on Merrick Garland? That's what you're saying?
If the Republicans control the Senate, they are already signaling that as far as they're concerned, eight is enough. They would rather have a tie, 4-4, as we have now, between Republican-leaning and Democratic-leaning justices on the Supreme Court, then allow Merrick Garland, who, while he is not viewed as a big-time liberal, is certainly not an Antonin Scalia conservative, and after all was the choice of Barack Obama and would then be the choice of Hillary Clinton, so obviously a Democratic appointee. Even Merrick Garland would be considered unacceptable, tainted by the appointment by a Democratic president. That is what the Republicans are signaling right now. Whether or not they would carry through on that, we don't know.
So early voting has been, I think, higher than average around the country. Is that true, Ron?
It has. And in fact, we're going from, well, there was a time we were vote, then a quarter of the vote. This year, we may approach a third vote early. And three states are now voting entirely by mail. We are moving into the 21st century with respect to our idea of voting. And there's a lot of controversy about this. A lot of people miss the idea of the whole country doing it on the same day. The problem with that is that having the whole country do it on one day gets real crowded at the polling places, and people wind up waiting 3, 4, 5 hours at some of the more crowded precincts. And that keeps them from voting because eventually they give up and go home. So that's not a great solution, especially because we don't want to spend too much money on building lots and lots and lots of polling places when we only use them once in a while. So fine, then we'll vote over a long period of time, and election day will be election deadline day, the last day to vote.
So what does it tell you that early voting, Michael, has been fairly high in North Carolina? What does that say to you about the outcome?
You know, it says to me first and foremost that North Carolinians continue to love the early voting. In 2012, 61% of all the ballots in that general election came before election day. This year, we could potentially see 65%. So two-thirds of North Carolinians could have already cast their ballots. Mm-hmm. Now, we've seen increases in the voter registration rolls from 6.6 to 6.8 million registered voters. So my prediction is we could potentially see in 2012, 4.5 million ballots cast. We could hit 4.7 million ballots cast. And out of that 4.7, 3.1 million have already been cast.
Wow.
So, you know, there were long lines for early voting in this state over the past 2 weeks. And so that says a lot to me in terms of trying to predict where this goes is anybody's guess, and I would be loath to try and do so because it's fundamentally different electorates.
And you said that both Democrat and Republican early voters in the state are up in number from previous elections, but what is really up are the number of unaffiliated voters going to the polls.
Over 40%.
And that's where the outcome of this rests. They have the power, right? There are more Democrats than Republicans.
Yes.
Where do the unaffiliated voters stack up in comparison?
Well, right now, they're basically in statewide voter registration numbers. They're tied with Republicans. So if you can think of the total 6.8 million voter registration pool as 40% Democrats, 30% Republicans, 30% unaffiliated. Mm-hmm. Now, in these early ballots, Democrats were 42%. Republicans were, I'm going to get these numbers maybe right, 31 or 32%. And unaffiliated were only 26%. But that's up from 20% 4 years ago.
These unaffiliated voters, are they really unaffiliated, or are they simply people because North Carolina allows you to vote, pick your primary, depending upon what party you belong to? So a lot of people have become unaffiliated so they can vote in a particular primary. Are they really unaffiliated, or are they Republicans or Democrats in sheep's clothing?
We know that it's actually the latter, I argue. We know that from national studies, most political independents, if you ask them the question, do you lean one way or do you lean to another party, they are leaners, and they actually vote at the same level as a strong partisan would for their party. So really about 15% of the national electorate could be considered pure independents. I think that mirrors in North Carolina probably slightly more Republican than necessarily Democratic, but the key is which generation do you come from and which region do you come from. That plays a huge factor in all of this.
We keep hearing, Ron, that polls around the country are narrowing in this contest, but then you'll come across one poll that will have Donald Trump 7 points ahead of Hillary Clinton, or maybe the reverse might be true. Does that always happen, or is there something going on with the electorate and pollsters this time around? Are people telling the truth to pollsters?
Polling is more difficult than it used to be, and it was never a perfect science. It involves a lot of art. It involves a lot of weighting of answers. It isn't a pure, we talked to this many people and they told us this. It's so hard to get certain demographics represented, particularly Hispanics. If you have a hard time finding one, when you find one, you overweight that particular voter. Mm. And we've seen this in many of the national polls.
And by overweighting, you mean that they apply more meaning to that. So if, if you got five Hispanics and 50 non-Hispanics,
their responses will count more in the final
percentages. Just so people know what we're talking about. Go ahead.
That's right. And of course, if the ones that you do find are perhaps just a little unusual and they are voting a little differently from most Hispanics, that can really skew your poll. That's been a big problem. We have seen a lot of the polls bounce around more than we might have expected. Generally speaking, the people who do this for a living and don't publish their results necessarily but work for the campaigns say that the mood swings that we see in the nationally published polls are exaggerated and that the race doesn't change that much. Back in 2012, the Obama campaign said that they had the campaign at 51-47 pretty much from the summer on. And while there were slight deviations of a point or two, no matter what on CNN or what you saw in the newspaper, it was a 51-47 race for the last 3 or 4 months pretty consistently. And on Election Day, it was 51-47.
Frank Luntz, who's a Republican pollster of some note, did a poll yesterday or a focus group yesterday for 60 Minutes. And he said, and you watch, he had a group of people in a room, and they were male, female, African-American, white, Hispanic, liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat, unaffiliated, etc. And he couldn't conduct it. And he's finding this to be the case across the country because they will not listen to each other. And all they want to do is yell at each other. And he says, fundamentally, this is social. This is an effect of social media where only what I have to say has any meaning. What you have to say is completely unimportant to me. So it's making it very difficult to poll people because and to hold focus groups because they won't talk to each other.
Right.
So you have said, Michael, that you worry more about what's going to happen on November 9th than what's going to happen on November 8th. And he's saying pretty much the same thing. Are we that? Are we going to have a riot depending upon what happens on November the 8th?
Well, I think we are that polarized. And I think for the losing side, whichever side it is, there will be an unwillingness to accept the reality of the loss and the fundamental disbelief that, you know, we need to take our country back, whatever that means. And what concerns me is that the rhetoric in this year's election has become so increasingly hot and, you know, visceral and just angry.
There are a lot of angry, frustrated people out there. We can debate all day if that anger and frustration has any basis in fact or it's justifiable to the degree that we're witnessing it here or that it can be cured or that it was caused by politicians and policies. But what happens to that sentiment if Donald Trump wins? What happens to that sentiment if he loses?
That is the question, and we expect that if the polls are not entirely wrong, there is a very strong possibility of a close win for either candidate. And that, I think, in and of itself is going to trigger a certain amount of resistance. We saw this in 2000. There were people who refused to believe that George W. Bush had been elected president. He had lost the popular vote nationwide by 500,000 votes, and they did not accept the result from Florida. It was hotly contested. There was a 5-4 decision in the Supreme Court. And on Inauguration Day in January of 2001, large groups of people turned out in Washington holding up signs essentially saying they did not think this man should be inaugurated, that he had not won the office, not just that they opposed him, but that he had no right to hold up his right hand.
What happens if it goes to the Supreme Court and we have a 4-4 split?
Please don't.
Well, please don't.
If Trump wins and Republicans maintain control of Congress, will the Congress act as a moderating force, or will Republicans see this as a mandate and let a President Trump follow through on killing trade deals, weakening NATO, deporting millions of immigrants, charging high tariffs for goods made by U.S. companies entering the country from overseas, etc.? Will they let him do what he wants to do?
I think the key will be the House Freedom Caucus and the House of Representatives. They will probably be more in line with a Trump agenda. But then you've got the rest of the Republican conference and who becomes Speaker of the U.S. House.
Given the fact that this is likely to be a very close race, Ron, how does NPR, NBC, CBS, etc., how do these big news organizations call these races before every vote is counted? How do you do it?
A lot of this is done by exit polling, and they feed the exit poll results. They ask people whom they voted for as they leave the polls in the morning and in the afternoon. We get three waves, I believe, of those exit polls, and that is used to inform a guess. And that guess was wrong in 2000, and then it was wrong again in 2000. It was a terrible night for the exit polls. The science of all of that and the mechanics of all that have been improved since, and we've seen better performance by those exit polls. But, you know, you're not going to want to put too much weight down on that. So speaking for NPR alone, we are not going to announce exit poll results and wait for the Associated Press to make calls. They will be looking at exit polls, but also at real votes. So we may not be the very first people to tell you any particular state, but we want to be right and we want not to mislead.
Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent for NPR. Dr. Michael Bitzer, provost of and political science professor at Catawba College. Thank you all for the